Daniel Jackson, professor of computer science at MIT.
Today's topic is for programmers. I'm going to explain why an idea from functional programming called immutability is so good and how you can put it to use in your own work. Let's start with objects. One of the central ideas of object-oriented programming is that instead of separating data and control into two separate parts of the program, lumps of data are formed into things called objects and have associated with them operations, usually called methods, that manipulate them. Now, strictly speaking, this notion of grouping data together with its operations isn't actually the innovation of object-oriented programming. It's the fundamental idea of what are called abstract data types. The notion of objects adds the idea that the choice of operation is determined at runtime by a mechanism called dynamic dispatch. But let's get back to objects and operations, and let's talk about them in terms of abstract types, since we might as well be precise about this. The idea of abstract types is not just that data can be grouped with operations, but that the meaning of the data is defined by those operations. So, integers, for example, are things you can add and multiply. Strings are things you can concatenate. Sets are things you can insert into, and so on. A remarkable field of study called algebraic specification showed that you could define precisely how the members of an abstract type behaved without ever giving any kind of representation at all for their data. For example, suppose you want to define the type set. You know what a set is. It's a collection of elements without repeats where the order of the elements is immaterial. Intuitively, you might think of a set as like a list, or better, as some kind of cloud, since the order of elements in a set doesn't matter. But using algebraic ideas, we can avoid even thinking of any representation. Here's a definition of how the key operations on sets behave. Ready? We divide the operations into constructors, which create new objects, mutators, which change the value of an object, and observers, which examine an object. For our set type, we might have just one constructor, which makes an empty set, two mutators, to add an element or delete an element, and two observers, one to check membership and tell you whether an object is a member of the set, and one to give you the size of the set. Now, to define the behavior, we just explain what happens when you apply each observer to the constructor and before and after applying each mutator. So let's start with the constructor. It makes an empty set. So if we apply size, we get zero. And if we do a membership check, we get false, whatever object we look up, because no object is a member of the empty set. Now let's do the add operation. After add, if we apply the membership check, we'll find that the object added is a member, of course, and all other objects are members if they were members before, and conversely, are not members if they weren't members before. If we apply the size operation, the size will be one more than the old size if the object added was not a member before, and otherwise it will be the same. Now, notice this definition is recursive. It defines the behavior of the operations in terms of the operations themselves. But since it always defines behavior after application in terms of behavior before, the recursive call is a simpler one, since it's on a shorter list of operations. So the whole definition is, in fact, well-formed. Now, I've actually lied to you. The operations of some data types are constructors, observers, and mutators, as I told you. But some other data types don't have any mutators. How could that be? How can you compute something if you can't change values? Well, think of the integers. There's no operation in any programming language to change the value of an integer. If you could do that, things would get really confusing. The integer called 2 might have the value 3 at some later point. Integers are an example of what's called an immutable type. Instead of having mutators that change the value of an object, immutable types have producers that create new values. So when you add 1 to an integer, the addition operation doesn't modify the integer, it creates a new one. Every basic data type that has a mutable version has an immutable version too. So you can define immutable sets, for example. These immutable sets don't ever change. You can't add an element to an immutable set. But if you call add on an immutable set, then what happens is you get back a new set, just like the old one, but with the element added. For most programmers, mutable types are their bread and butter, and the idea of immutable types makes them a little bit queasy. It's true that you have to program slightly differently with immutable types. The main issue is that you can't make local modifications to a structure. If you have a tree, for example, and you want to add an element to it, you have to create a new tree. This might sound like a terrible idea, because you might think you always have to copy the old object to make the new one. In fact, though, you can often avoid doing any copying at all, and paradoxically, you can end up doing much less copying than you might do with mutable types. Here's an example. Suppose you're writing a program that does a recursive search to construct a list with some value that satisfies some property. For example, you're trying to find a sequence of moves that wins a game of chess. Well, with immutable lists, you could program it like this. At each step, you take a possible next move, and you make a new list containing the old list of moves plus the new move. This new list contains just the new move and a pointer to the old list of moves, so making it requires no copying. Now you try this list out, and if it works, you're done. If not, you back off and go back to the old list and try adding a different move to it. This works really beautifully. Now, suppose instead we were using mutable lists. When we add the new move, that modifies the value of the list. Now, when we want to go back to the old list, we no longer have it since it got obliterated by the modification. What are we going to do? Well, we have two choices. We can either undo the addition by removing the move from the list, or instead of modifying the list on doing the add, we can take a copy of it and modify the copy so that the original isn't affected. You can see, I hope, that neither of these approaches is very good, and both are in fact likely to run more slowly than the immutable version. So performance is sometimes a reason to use immutability, but I'm sure you're aware of the fact that performance is very rarely the key issue in software engineering. Getting it right is usually much more important than getting it to go fast. What use is a fast program if it computes the wrong value? The larger reason for immutable types, then, is to make programs easier to understand. Why do immutable types do this? It's because they avoid a nasty phenomenon known as aliasing. Suppose I have a mutable Java set created by calling the constructor of hash set, for example. So I've written something like sgets_hashset.new. I say gets, by the way, instead of equals, to remind myself and my students that the equal symbol is an assignment symbol and not an equality operator. Now, let's execute the assignment tgets_s, introducing a new variable t and assigning to it the value of the variable s. What does that do? It causes the variable t to refer to the very same set that s refers to. Now, if I do an add on the set s, writing, for example, s.add of something, t will have appeared to have changed too. This is really nasty, because the value of the set associated with t was changed by a statement that didn't even mention t. This is called aliasing, and s and t are said to be aliased, since they are aliases, or alternative names, for the very same object. And this is just the simplest form of aliasing. It can get a lot worse because aliases can be created inside objects. You can have two different fields of different objects that are aliased. And this kind of internal alias can be a side effect of a method call. This isn't a theoretical problem. Aliasing plagues large object-oriented programs and makes them much harder to understand. The designers of Java's libraries got into an awful mess because they originally made the date type mutable. It meant that you could put a date inside an object, and then its value might change later, even if the object containing the date was never changed. So good programmers use immutability whenever they can. Whenever they create a new type, that is, design a new class, they ask themselves if it really has to be mutable, and if not, they make it immutable. Immutability, admittedly, isn't always the right thing. Some objects represent entities in the real world that have a fixed identity and a changing value. A library member, for example, is a changing entity, and you'd want a mutable type to model things like a change of address. But even in a situation like this, you have to be careful. The address itself might not need to be a mutable object. When a library member changes address, we can create a brand new address for him or her. Asking yourself whether the object has an identity is a good trick. The library member certainly does, but his or her address certainly does not.
If you'd like to learn more about immutability and its power, and see examples of how to build and use immutable types, let me recommend to you one of my favorite programming books. It's Joshua Bloch's Effective Java, published by Sun and Prentice Hall. The book isn't really about Java. It's a collection of short essays, which you can read in any order, that explain simple and powerful ideas that will make you a better programmer.
Copyright 2009, Daniel Jackson. Introductory music, copyright Chris Bremer, from pianosociety.com.